Good morning and welcome to the West Building Lecture Hall of the National Gallery of Art. I'm Eric Denker with the staff of the Education Division, and this is the first of four lectures to provide the necessary context to appreciate the Tintoretto exhibition, which is currently upstairs through July 7th. Today and Saturday, I want to give a little bit of background to what's going on in 16th century Venetian painting, and then to next week talk about the early Tintoretto, only sparsely represented in the exhibition upstairs, and then after a break to come back and talk about San Rocco and his great achievement in the decoration of the Scuola Grande di San Rocco, and then finally to give you some idea of what is still in situ in Venice and how you might make an itinerary around Venice to see and understand that great accomplishment. This is the Jacopo de Barbari view of Venice from 1500. It is one of the great technological achievements of this moment on six large sheets of paper to get this verifiable bird's eye view of Venice, done from the towers of San Giorgio Maggiore and of San Giovanni Battista out on the Giudecca and San Giorgio, respectively. It shows Venice in 1500, and we need to know something about the political situation at this time as we pave the way for the understanding of first Bellini and then the followers of Bellini. So Venice itself is the city that you see before you, but it is the capital of a great maritime empire, an empire that stretches all the way to islands along the Turkish coast, includes islands in the Aegean, in the Adriatic, and then at this moment also includes a great landmass across the northern part of Italy. The view that you see here helps us to define, to picture the capital city at this moment. It is a city with a defining grand canal, this S-shaped curve dividing the city into two larger sections of three sestieri on each side. And the sestieri of Castello includes the greatest manufacturing compound in Europe at this time, the arsenal. The people who live along the poorer areas here are probably mostly fishermen. It is made up of about 110 islands, which are connected by 450 bridges. And so we are out in the middle of a lagoon in the northwest part of the Adriatic. The situation in 1500 is that there are about 110,000 people who are living in this city. They are divided up into three categories of the residents, and the uppermost of those categories is a patrician category, the patrizi, and these are made up of families, some 200 families, who were inscribed in the Golden Book during the closing of the Golden Book back between 1297 and 1320, and who are eligible to serve in this republic, in this oligarchy. And that includes the Doge, the Council of Ten. It includes the procurators, the treasurers, all of the senior government officials. And this makes up perhaps 1% of the population, 1,500 to 2,000 at a given time. The next level down are the cittadini, the citizens. And these may be well-established families or they may be fairly new. They have a certain affluence. They're important as merchants, as traders. And this makes up, again, about 2 or 3% of the city. And most of the rest of the city would be considered to be popolare. This is the working class. And the working class includes arsenal workers, it includes fishermen, sailors, it includes artisans of every conceivable type. Because at this moment in 1500, Venice is the single richest, most powerful, and cosmopolitan state in Europe. But that's going to begin to ebb away. And there are factors that will lead to turmoil within the society, but also lead to a blossoming within artistic circles of a variety of ideas and developments. And so around 1500, when this map is made, the Portuguese have just managed to find the sea route to India so that they don't have to go through the Middle East. The dominance of Venetian trade is broken in that way. The ever-present threat of the Turks to their trade is a factor in the burgeoning of the Ottoman Empire. And beyond that, we also know that the great wealth of the New World is pouring into Europe, but not into Venice, because Venetian ships are not really ocean-worthy. They're seaworthy for the Mediterranean, but they're not really meant for a transatlantic crossing. So these will be important factors. In addition, as you look at this image, it concentrates specifically on the major areas of the city. If we look here, we can see the Piazza San Marco, its bell tower, the Doge's palace, the seat of the Doge, the Senate, the Council of Ten, and the shopping street which leads from here, the Merceria, which leads up to the Rialto Bridge, which is over here, and you will notice that's the only span across the canal. It's important to cite the fact that this area will be largely destroyed by fire in 1514, leading to renewed opportunities for artists in the decoration of buildings on both sides of the Grand Canal. What I think is also important here is, and there's the Rialto Bridge, and again, all of these buildings here, the exception of the Church of San Bartolomeo, San Giacomo survives, but all of this and the financial offices here are destroyed as well. And so this is an important historical fact. But there's something else going on here as well, and that is that Venice is at its most expansionist in terms of wanting more and more of the mainland. And this is probably partly a result of the publishing industry, which is publishing a great deal of ancient texts, including Virgil and others, who celebrate the pastoral life and who celebrate the idea of the villa and the Roman villa. And this has to do with the Venetian mentality at this moment as well. And so they're expansionist, and they're working across. They already own Padova, they already own Verona. They are working toward Bergamo, and this is a threat to mainland powers, both in Italy and around Europe. And so in 1508, the League of Cambrai is formed under the auspices of the papacy. And it includes Spain, and it includes France, and it includes the Holy Roman Emperor. It includes the Milanese, it includes Tuscany, and of course the papacy itself, which is not confined to the small Vatican States, but has a large part of Emilia-Romagna. And so this league is an alliance against Venice and against this expansion. And so in 1509, at the Battle of Agnadello, the Venetians are soundly defeated. And although they'll get much of this land back over the next decade, it really stops the greater expansionist tendencies at this time. One of the interesting things that we see about the Jacopo de' Barbari is the minimal amount of attention paid to the mainland. To situate you, here is the Rialto. Here are the two islands that have been put into one island by filling in between San Michele. Here is Murano, and you can see it labeled over here. But here is the mainland, and you can see that Jacopo de' Barbari and the people working for him have minimized what's on the mainland, not wanting to call attention to this expansion, to the goals of Venetians at this time. It is not a government-sponsored project. And St. Mark is not in evidence on this map, nor is the Virgin who the city is dedicated to. Instead, we have a very secular version. Here, in fact, the map is dedicated to both Mercury and Neptune, and here is Mercury, and what it says underneath is that Mercury presides over the greatest emporium in the world. These are merchants, and their wealth comes from trade. And that trade is on spices, that trade is on pigments, on textiles, on a variety of different products that they control as they enter into Europe. Well, to show the city this size and the mainland this size is something of a distortion. It's a distortion that I think Saul Sternberg recognized in his New Yorker's view of the United States. Here is Venice. There's the lagoon, and suddenly there's Jersey and Kansas City, Nebraska, Los Angeles, and China and Japan. It's the same kind of quite willful distortion, taking into account the people who would be the audience for this work. This is one of the first paintings done for the Palazzo Camerlenghi, the financial offices, after it is reconstructed, after the fire of 1514. And although now it is seen in the Doge's palace, we have to understand its real context, because that's the painting above, and it's quite a large painting for Carpaccio, and fairly late in his career. And what it shows is deliberately symbolic, because there is the Lion of St. Mark, the symbol of Venice. And you'll notice that while the back feet are in the water, he's stepping back onto the land, symbolic of the fact that they have taken back some of the land and some of the power that goes with the ownership of that land now by 1516. And the lion is in front of several important elements that tell us about the power of Venice. So that on this side, here's a detail, what we see is the Doge's palace, the domes of the basilica over here, the bell tower, and the molo, the walkway outside. This is the seat of power for the Venetians, but that power is based on shipping and the marriage of Venice to the sea, which is normally done at the Church of San Nicolo de Lido, and just a couple of references to the arsenal and the power created by their ability to produce ships at an enormously quick rate. So that will provide something of the historic and political background, and I want you to bear in mind as we go through that we will also have the repercussions of the Reformation, 1517, beginning with the Martin Luther, but then taking off from there, that they will deal with the repercussions of the sack of Rome as many artists and architects and writers escape from Rome and come north to this affluent city. And that later on, we will have to deal with the Counter-Reformation and the ideas of the Council of Trent, which are promulgated between 1540 and 1561, and have various different doctrinal pronouncements that will affect both Tintoretto and Titian, and to a lesser extent, Veronese. For us to understand the artistic moment, we have to start with the leading artist in the latter part of the 15th century in Venice, the artist from whom almost all younger artists of importance come through his studio, and that is Giovanni Bellini. Bellini was the painter to the state. This was a very important position. He did a lot of decorations, which have unfortunately perished in the Doge's palace and a number around Venice as well. So in one sense, we'll deal with the state of the altarpiece in his work, but also devotional images and eventually mythological images as well. So this is a work called the Frari Altarpiece. It's from about 1480. There are a number of external influences working to help Venetian painting to evolve. These include the presence of Andrea Mantegna, who is in fact Giovanni Bellini's brother-in-law, and who specializes in both mythological scenes as well as religious scenes. It will include the entry of Antonello da Messina into Venice for a year in 1475, and the innovations that he was using in oil paint, but also in terms of composition. And what we have here is the early expression from the Church of the Franciscans, the Frari of Santa Maria Glorioso da Frari. And it shows a sacra conversazione, a subject we'll come up against time and again. And that is a figure of the Madonna and Child, or perhaps of another saint, surrounded by saints who stand passively as if engaged in conversation of some kind of eschatological nature. And so here we have the Madonna and Child. They are up on a little platform. There are music-making angels, those lovely, charming music-making angels down below. And then on either side, there are a series of saints, two saints on either side. The fictive space within the picture, separated from our space by the picture plane, which is on a perpendicular to our line of sight, is in fact this fictive space continues the framing device that you see here, so that it's repeated and continued within. And we have an imaginary barrel vault here with an apse that is of mosaics. And this is a reminder to us that Venetian art is a very traditional art and is often looking back as a conservative art to earlier art and monuments within the city. And that this is clearly, these mosaics are clearly a reference to the Basilica of San Marco and the mosaics that decorate this very important institution. What I would suggest here is that although the space is now well defined, that it is not a very accurate space, that it is a claustrophobic space. We can't actually imagine this space as part of a chapel on either side. And she's rather large for this space, and we're not entirely sure how she ascended to this platform. It gives us some pause. While the figures are well rendered three-dimensionally, there is still a sense that there is a very sharp focus and a very clear contour and outline to the figures, which puts Bellini very firmly in what we would consider to be Quattrocento art, not only in Venice, but having been inspired by Florentine art and the importance of drawing design and outline. It is only a short leap in time, but a great leap in artistic imagination for the artist to move to this, the San Giobbe altarpiece. In Venice, there are churches that are dedicated to Old Testament figures who become saints. And so there is Saint Job, Saint Moses, Saint Jeremiah. These are all Old Testament figures who have been made into a kind of pantheon of Venetian saints. And so what's happened here? Those artificial divisions of the triptych have been removed. And now we have a greater understanding spatially of what's going on. Now, unfortunately, this has been wrenched out of the frame that still exists in the Church of San Giobbe in a poorer section of Canareggio. It's unfortunate because the framing itself, the stone structure, continues the architecture within, but now you can see it's become quite spacious. And there's nothing of that sense of claustrophobia. And the figures have been integrated in the same space with the Madonna and Child, richly colored, as the angels down below, the music-making angels, have become more realistic, closer to a sense of natural quality. And we have St. Francis and St. Job, St. Sebastian over here. We recognize these saints, but now they interact within the same space. And the space is a sacred space. We understand it in precisely that way. Within 20 years, Bellini would be called upon to do yet another of these altarpieces, now for a rather more important church, San Zaccaria, not far behind the Ducal Palace. And here we get a not only greater sense of spaciousness, but there is greater space and atmosphere around the figures themselves. And they're not so completely crowded in. We're limited to the one music-making angel. The richness of the costumes ever greater. And now this pavilion, which again continues the architecture, this pavilion is now set in nature. And so we get some sense of the outdoors here as well. She sits against the throne. Bellini has minimized the cloth of honor hanging down behind here, and instead we're getting to a greater and greater sense of the naturalness of these figures, but they now move with a calm, a dignity, a kind of gracefulness that belies their origins as figures posing in the studio. I'm going to constantly refer to alternatives that are going on at this same moment. And so if we go back to the Frari for a moment, in the Chapel of the Milanese, we would find this painting, which is done at almost precisely the same time. This is the Chapel of the Milanese, and the Milanese patron saint is Santa Ambrogio. St. Ambrose, and so it is St. Ambrose here enthroned among multiple saints. And this is by Alvise Vivarini. The tradition in Venice, much more so in many ways than in other cities throughout Italy, is the family workshop. And so he worked with uncles and he worked with brothers, and the Vivarini lasted as a workshop over a long period of time. They were the great rivals of the Bellini workshop, which includes Jacopo the father, which includes Gentile, Giovanni's brother, which includes other people in the sphere of Bellini. So when you look at this, look at the hard-edged realism here and the sense of crispness in the folds of the drapery, in the anatomy, in the architecture itself. And we can see that this is an alternative direction, that it is much more heavily reliant on Quattrocento ideas than the older Bellini, evolving and picking up some of the aspects of what's happening in the High Renaissance in central Italy. This is crowded. It is very hard-edged, crystalline. It's a very different kind of approach, which almost completely lacks a sense of atmosphere. Likewise, in doing portraits, Bellini does this marvelous portrait of Doge Leonardo Loredan in 1500, where in addition to the magnificent ducal outfit done almost as if we could read it thread by thread, that nice, soft, atmospheric transition in the planes of the face and in the details of light and shadow. This becomes overwhelmingly important as an expressive element in late Bellini and in the Bellini's followers. And again, we can compare the softness of the modeled form with Alvise Vivarini, in these two fragments from an altarpiece, it's clear that he's using a particular figure to pose in these as these nuns, as saints, perhaps as well. We recognize the model, if you will, but it is much harder edged, and they are much less atmospheric. These are in the Accademia Museum in Venice today. And again, we can go back and look at Bellini and think about the fact that he has a greater understanding of the expressive value of light and shadow and the manipulation of paint. And so here in this image of the Madonna and Child with Saints Catherine and Mary Magdalene from about 1490, they emerge out of shadows. There is no attempt to put them into some readable space. Instead, it is the drama of light as it plays across them. And yet we also sense that these are not idealized figures, that these are actual models that he's using. And we have an understanding of his sympathy for the human figure and for human expression. And I think you can see that particularly with the figure of the saint on the right. You will also notice that instead of the normal devotional vertical of the Madonna with saints, now Bellini has experimented with this broader horizontal. And this is unusual, and it allows him a little bit more space to either side of the Madonna and Child. And there, I think, really one of the most touching of what are essentially portraits of people posing for these sacred images. And we can sense that in his work, as we do here from the Metropolitan, where he's using typical conventions. He still has the cloth of honor behind. There's the parapet in the foreground. The child is very much an infant, and she's very much a young mother. We sense that we could identify them if they were on the street with us in Venice. And yet, he's offset now the cloth to one side, and now he's given us a little bit of a village, and then the Dolomites there in the background. And so it is the Bellini's new appreciation for landscape that we begin to see here, and that will be carried through in this, the Madonna of the Meadow, now in the Brera collection in Milan, which dates to about 1505. And here he's eliminated the parapet, he's eliminated the cloth of honor, he has used that horizontal format, but here he's used it to make parallels within the undulating aspects of nature, the village in the background, and that beautiful sky, again, with the Dolomite scene in the distance. This new appreciation for nature and this suggestion between the parallel of these figures and nature itself. Most of you will be familiar with this painting, which is in the permanent collection, Feast of the Gods. We know that Bellini only takes up scenes that are mythological after the death of his brother-in-law, Mantegna, in 1506. It's as if there had been a tacit agreement that Bellini wouldn't pursue this direction. He completes a project that Mantegna had begun, but then he is called to the court in Este, and he's probably around 80 years old when this painting is begun. It is one of a series of mythological images that was for the Camerino d'Alabastro, the alabaster room, the kind of treasury of Alfonso d'Este down in Ferrara. And it is a great example of Bellini interpreting and reinterpreting the works of Ovid within the context of this kind of Renaissance literary classical culture. Initially, it appears that these figures were not meant to be identified each individually as gods and goddesses, that came later. What's important here is this kind of shallow space, relief-like, reminding us of classical sarcophagi, and the figures, and they are set, the story is being narrated out in nature. You have to imagine that this arcade of trees was extended all the way across, and that this is a later addition. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes as well. So, this is 1514. What else is going on? Who else is working? Well, certainly his brother Gentile Bellini, at work for the Scuola San Giovanni Evangelista, is doing one of a set of paintings that have to do with the worship of the piece of the Golden Cross, devotion of the various different Scuole members down here as it's carried through in its reliquary carrier. And yet it is set in contemporary Venice. But the figures all look a little stiff. And again, there's a kind of lack of atmosphere. Instead, we're allowed to concentrate on the structure of the basilica itself, of the old procurator's office buildings over here. These buildings would be torn down to provide an even greater ceremonial space and allowing the campanile to be freestanding. It is an iconic, festive scene that shows Gentile at his best, but again, lacking in a sense of the light and shadow and the atmosphere and the kinds of things that his brother Giovanni had been exploring. Likewise, this is done at a very similar moment. Carpaccio comes out of Bellini's studio. These are some of the students, and Carpaccio, decorating a smaller scuola, the Scuola San Giorgio delle Schiavone, is doing scenes from the life of St. George, St. Augustine, and others. Here is his rather delightful depiction of St. George having come along to subdue the dragon, to save the princess, who's over here on the extreme right. See her over here, in front of a kind of centrally designed building and an evocation of a number of Renaissance buildings. There are these slightly horrific and I would suppose partly ironically humorous images of people who had been sacrificed before or who had been less successful as St. George rides in to save the day. Most famously in this regard is this image of the vision of St. Augustine. It shows him in his studio as he becomes aware of the death of St. Jerome, mystically aware of the death of St. Jerome, as that dog is probably even more sensitive to than he is. What Carpaccio has done here is to allow us an insight into what a contemporary humanist studio would look like. And so we get both religious artifacts, the Christ Salvator Mundi back here, Christ Triumphant, but along with a series of bronzes, both ancient and Renaissance bronzes, and volumes and books and music, and the desk, and the astrolabe, all of these that we think of when we think of the collection of a scholar at this time and the specifics of scholarly pursuits. I should mention that there is in the works the cleaning of his great St. Ursula series. It is almost done, and it will also give us insights not only into his creative narratives, but also into contemporary life, and it will be reopened shortly in Venice. Another artist who comes out of his studio and does this work at approximately the same time is Cima, who comes from Conigliano, Cima da Conigliano. And this is his Adoration of the Shepherds. It's in the Church of Santa Maria del Carmine in Venice, and it's from about 1509-1510. And it shows that aspect that Cima had picked up from Giovanni Bellini, and that is his love of nature. That here the figures are in the foreground. They're pressed fairly close to the picture plane. We get a variety of different figures, not only the adoration that's taking place of the shepherds, but the presence of the St. Catherine over here, of St. Helen over here, but also the presence of the Archangel and Tobias over here, so that we get this collection, this kind of sacred conversation combined with this image of an adoration. But look at the expanse of nature. And from Conegliano, you do get this view of the Dolomites. You're already on the mainland, you're much closer. The foothills of the Alps seen here in the distance, this walled city, which could be any number of walled cities, and the sense of nature that's here represented in this painting. So the greatest of these pupils coming out of Bellini's studio by about 1500 is Giorgione Zorzo da Castelfranco, another artist who comes to the city to work with Bellini, and then comes out of Bellini's studio and has this significant number of innovations. And so we can see that here with the Adoration, the Allendale Nativity that is upstairs. And right away, you can sense that something is happening here, that there's a difference between anything that we've seen so far. And that is a much greater sense of atmosphere itself, a softening of the hard edges of the people, of the landscape, of elements in that landscape. And we generally credit this to the presence of Leonardo da Vinci in Venice already in 1500, and his sense of atmosphere and sfumato, which will be integral to the evolution of Venetian painting from this point onward. In addition, we can sense Giorgione's affection for that landscape by the displacement of the Holy Family from the center of this scene over to the right. In front of a cave, this is the Byzantine tradition, if we want to go back to early Venetian art, they are outside, the shepherds are there, they pay homage to the Christ child on a bit of drapery coming down, not to put the Christ child on the ground. And then the first witnesses that the New Testament narrative tells us of the birth of Christ, the ox and the ass, which disappear into the shadows of the cave. As these angels, these upper orders of angels, heads with wings, cherubim and seraphim, disappear into the shadows and into the vines that you see here. And then we get half of the painting given over to this magnificent essay of nature with the Dolomites in the background and with various different formations and shrubs. Nature has assumed a much more important role than it had had previously. It is with Giorgione that we talk about the beginning of a kind of lyric image that's not necessarily explicitly narrative, but is left partly up to the evocation of classical imagery in the viewer's and critic's imagination. So that this is called The Tempest. And The Tempest seems largely about the storm that's going on back here. But mysteriously, the painting has eluded specific analysis by way of the woman with the child over here, by way of the soldier who stands here with a spear, or perhaps a shepherd, by way of these truncated columns. And so what we get is a kind of lyric aspect to the transitory elements of the natural world, of a storm. What could last more briefly than that? What could be more ephemeral than that? And it evokes something of the fascination, but also the mystery of nature. It is Giorgione in his half-length paintings who also explores with a depth of understanding a kind of human psychology that had not been current before. And we can see that here in La Vecchia, painting an older woman who holds a piece of paper that says col tempo, with time. And it evokes that biblical quotation, as you are now, I once was, as I am now, you will be. The passage of time. And she looks out at us, her teeth worn down with age, her mouth slightly open, wrinkles on her cheek, her hair thinning. Now, there were attempts to make this into a portrait of Giorgione's mother, but this is impossible. It's not a portrait. It's an evocation of a particular psychological moment, of a particular stage in life. And we find it in Giorgione, and it will be picked up by his friend, the young Titian, who also is involved with Giorgione's premature death in 1510, with the completion of a number of images, including this, the Sleeping Venus, now in Dresden, which we date to about 1510. And here again, it is not just that it's a Sleeping Venus, a classical figure, but that she is placed out in a landscape that has the same undulating rhythms as her body and connects her to the earth and the fecundity of the earth as well. And bear this in mind, because we'll have reason to come back and make reference to it as well. It is precisely at this moment, perhaps at the time of their collaboration, that it appears that the young Titian has done his most Giorgione-esque painting of the birth of poetry, of these figures seated out of doors, the musician well-dressed and urban, the figure more rustic over here on the right of a peasant. And these apparently are not meant to be figures from contemporary life, but they're muses, their inspiration, that neither one actually makes contact with either of those men. And they seem to exist on a higher plane, on this kind of imaginary inspirational plane, again, set in verdant nature. That painting will help to inspire this painting many years later by Manet, this idea of, Manet did not suspect that they were muses who were only there in imagination, but of contemporary nudity, and that it was perfectly appropriate as it had been in the Renaissance. And he does a series of paintings at about this time, the young Titian, which have to do with beauty and idealized beauty. This is Flora, and Flora is seen here, so in about 1515 to 1520. It is an idealized, voluptuous young woman, the drapery just low enough to expose the breast while she covers up the other shoulder and the rest of her body. And it is this idealized sense of a figure, allegorical figure of nature. And it will help to influence his young compatriot, Sebastiano del Piombo, who leaves for Rome, but takes some of these ideas with him as well. And there is a fertile interaction between the two. The young Titian embarks on a number of both private and public commissions. The Nolle mi tangere, the touch me not of about 1514, now in the National Gallery in London, is one of those early images that shows an absolutely lyrical approach to this narrative scene. The painting itself is too small to have been on an altar. It must have been for private devotion. It is that moment where on Easter, Magdalene thinks that she comes upon the gardener to ask him what he's done with the body of Christ. And he moves away, but look at this amazing pose. We've seen nothing like it. All the figures that we've seen to this point seem static in comparison, because not only does he gently lean out of the way, but his body rotates as he moves away to avoid that touch. And notice how the landscape and the figures intersect to emphasize this. The strong diagonal line as it comes down the hillside and curves here, and then the line that comes up and through this arm, and the intersection is right here with the tree, so that we're brought right into Christ and his gentle expression as he gently moves away from the figure of the Magdalene. He is given a great commission, very much sought after, to do the image of the Assumption of the Virgin in the Frari, And this is to be done in the apse of this great Gothic church. And he has a number of challenges here. The painting itself is 22 feet high, and it needs to be seen from down the nave of the church through the area that is for the various different clergy. And so I'm showing it to you here pre-cleaning so that I can show you what it looks like today. As a result of a recent cleaning showing the tremendous impact of Titian and his ability to separate this scene into three different registers and to give the sense of a great pyramid, but not just a pyramid, of a vortex. So we have the apostles down here below, and two of these apostles are actually inspired by Raphael and the images that he had been working on in the Vatican in Rome. And then above, larger than life size, here is Mary in this traditional pose, being lifted by all of these figures of angels cascading down and lifting her up in the clouds to God the Father, calm in glory, up above, surrounded also by angels, if you can get enough detail, if you can see closely enough. And this burst of golden light, and it is light that unifies, light and color that unifies this composition, from the reds that are here through Mary herself up to the rich molten color up above, to the distinction between the cooler colors separating the heavenly realm from the earthly realm. And this is a tremendous accomplishment. And in order to do this, he had to align it with the axis of the church itself and to take into account the lighting, the stained glass and the glass that came from around it. And so it rises to the level of the first arches. And the figures here rise to the level of the lower windows. It is all perfectly in alignment so that you see it from really 50 yards away, and it works as this dominating Assumption of the Virgin in a church dedicated to Saint Mary in glory among the Franciscans. Unusually, we have a record of it being brought by the diarist. Marino Sanudo talks about the importance of this work, and it's somewhat controversial. People argue about how different it is, and how different it is both in the way it's painted and in the sense of atmosphere and in the composition. And Titian takes on this composition just slightly later. And so he takes this, and this is the altar of the Pesaro family, and Jacopo Pesaro is memorialized just next to it. There is a wall tomb. And what Titian has done, and I think this is very important because it will come into play when we talk about Tintoretto upstairs, is to take into account that this is not in a chapel, it's on the wall. The space has to be created fictively. There is no real space where it is. And that you will be approaching it from the entrance at the end of the nave, and that it needs to be revealed almost cinematographically, so that you come to it not from the perpendicular where you are, but you come to it from where I am. And he takes this into account, because the first thing he does is to offset the Madonna and Child. They're no longer in the center of some kind of sacra conversazione. This is a devotional painting. It is Jacopo Pesaro and the Pesaro family here who are being introduced to the Madonna and Child by Saint Francis and by Saint Peter, who also introduces another member of the Pesaro family who had recently won a great victory over the Turks at Santa Mauro. And that's why a chained Turk is over here. So first he displaces them, and then he puts them on a diagonal so that we go up the steps this way to get to her, which makes more sense from where I am than from directly in front of the painting. And that's the diagonal that then leads us up here to the Madonna and Child, which is then completed by the triangle that comes down and has St. Francis introducing the rest of the family. There is evidence that Titian struggled with the architecture, that originally he had a kind of barrel vault over here, but he's done something very clever. He has displaced the major part of the architecture, and then he's put these two columns in, and again, he seems to have wrestled with that because originally there may have been capitals, but instead he has them simply continue up into the heavens so that we are in a heavenly building of enormous, monumental stature. And then he keeps our eye from simply going off by having a number of angels here playing with symbols of the Passion, which allude to the later crucifixion of Christ. It is beautifully colored in terms of the richness of the pigments, and perhaps only Titian at this moment would have conceived of the idea of balancing the Madonna and Child over here with the richness of the red flag of the troops, of the papal troops over here. After Bellini's death in 1516, Titian will pick up the mantle of some of the larger paintings that had been planned for Alfonso d'Este. In this case, Titian added this large area here. In his own mind, no doubt, competing with Bellini, who had been not only his master, but the painter to the state, showing that he could improve on Bellini. He does other paintings for Alfonso, and he does this painting in particular, so that what we're doing is comparing this somewhat calm and reserved nymph as Priapus lifts up her drapery. But there's nothing voluptuous here about this nude. She's exposed, but there is nothing erotically charged. Titian puts in an erotically charged figure there. And this is his Bacchanal of the Andrians. It's done for that same image and set. And you can see that now the way in which the hillside comes down would visually connect over here and balance the two together, and then all of these larger figures in motion. Not static the way they had been in the Bellini, but in every conceivable motion, which is picked up on by the use of light and shadow. And the third of these paintings, actually slightly earlier, the Worship of Venus over here, and it's Titian's great lyric to childhood, to all of these little pudi pinching and pushing each other and looking guilty or looking happy, totally innocent. And that's really what this painting is all about, all of them pushed in together in this way and cavorting and carousing around in this way. And we can see that in the detail as well. Again, Titian has competitors. We tend to think that Titian has the field all to himself, but he has competitors, and these include Palma Vecchio, who is working at this time here, almost roughly contemporary, the Polyptych of St. Barbara that is in Santa Maria Formosa, executed in 1524-25. So on the one hand, this is certainly retardatory to have the Polyptych in this architecture broken down into all of these different zones. But when we look at St. Barbara herself, it is a full-figured high Renaissance, dominating figure in a wonderful pose, fully realized and idealized, so that it's clear that Titian has brought certain ideas with him that other artists will pick up on, even if they're working in a more conservative place. That's true also of Lorenzo Lotto, who did this image of St. Nicholas in glory with St. John the Baptist and St. Lucy. And this is done at about the same time, 1527 to 29, in the church of Santa Maria del Carmine. Lotto, an itinerant artist, spends about 7 years in Venice. This is toward the end of that time. And he is very different from Titian. Look at his emphasis on these beautiful materials, on this striking, really very non-Venetian color, and on the image of these saints up above a landscape which has clouds and a changeable atmosphere, and actually has St. George and the dragon down over here. Perhaps the most important competitor at this moment is Pordenone. Pordenone from the mainland city of Pordenone does these two large figures of St. Martin and St. Christopher at this same moment, 1528-29, and they are done for the Church of San Rocco. They are normally quite high up on the wall. They were cabinet covers. They were doors to cabinets. Today they are on display on the floor of the church, recently having been conserved. What they show is somebody who is looking at Central Italian art and bringing that Central Italian art to Venice. These are large, Michelangelo-esque, muscular bodies by an artist who is aware of Giulio Romano and of Michelangelo. And they are over life size, robust figures, and it must have proved quite a challenge to what Titian was doing at this moment to see this kind of competitor working on such a large scale. A second Pordenone that was in a church close to the Rialto that gives away a different influence. This is Pordenone, and this is of St. Catherine, St. Sebastian, and San Rocco, and it's in the church of San Giovanni e le Monasterio. It was done in 1533. Look at how those three saints are squeezed into a space that is barely adequate for them. And look at the distortion in the anatomy here of Sebastian, or of this difficult pose and foreshortening for St. Roque, or spatially where we understand St. Catherine to be. All of these compressed, distorted, show the influence of the mannerism that is so strong in central Italy at this time, seen in the work of a Bronzino, a Pontormo, a Beccafumi, a Rosso Fiorentino. This willful distortion of anatomy, of space, of color, it is in many ways the single most mannerist painting in Venice, and it was calculated to be odd and disturbing to those who were still working in a much more naturalistic environment. Or this, Bonifacio di Pitate. Tintoretto may well have worked alongside him. This another painting. Where's the subject? It's no longer in the foreground. We got a lot of people here holding books, sitting in odd positions, but the space itself has been contorted. What's the subject here? It's Christ among the doctors, but he's all the way back here. He's dwarfed by the size of these figures, and the perspective leads us back toward him and toward this dispute in this very odd architectural structure. Let's go back to Titian for a few more minutes as we suggest some of the comparisons. And that begins with this painting, the Venus of Urbino from 1538, a painting that is clearly based on the Sleeping Venus by Giorgione, but now placed in a more domestic setting. And it wasn't even called Venus until a century and more later. This type of female nude was to be inspirational later on Manet as well. Titian does a whole series of nude goddesses, which he attempts to raise to a higher level, to a more rarefied level. They are his poesia, this poetic, lyric image, not meant to be narrative, but meant to be isolated as a poetics of beauty and lyric quality. And we see that again and again. We see it here in the Danae that's in Madrid from 1553-54. And now we're talking about work that is roughly contemporary with what you'll see of Tintoretto upstairs. But let's go back for a moment. Titian's also a great portraitist. And we've been at some pains to introduce Tintoretto portraits in the exhibition, but what in fact is Titian's trajectory in terms of portraiture? Certainly early on, perhaps around 1510, he does this member of the Barbarigo family, this man with the blue sleeve in the National Gallery in London, which is characterized by a kind of hyper-realism. Look at the stitching on the sleeve, which literally billows out into our space in a way that Giorgione and Bellini would never have attempted. And then the details there, and then that aristocratic pose and that strong aristocratic gaze. All of this showing the early Titian anchored to this kind of realism. And certainly people like Cariani understood this in this painting, which comes from about the same time. And we're also thinking in terms of Giorgione and the expression of human emotion, in addition to the breaking down of the barrier between the viewer and the sitter. We tend to think of Titian in these elegant images, the man with the glove here, largely done in gray and black so that it sets off the color in the hand, the jewel, the little bit of red on the lips and the white of the eyes. This kind of elegance characterized Titian's portraiture in the 20s and 30s. And I want you to notice that his figures often don't look directly out at us, that he looks off into the distance in a kind of contemplative pose. But there are other artists on the scene who are competing with him. So Lorenzo Lotto, again, in this portrait of the collector Andrea Odoni, done in 1527. We know that Lotto is a very inventive artist. He's moved the portrait from its normal vertical to this horizontal that gives him a little more space to work with all of the various attributes of the collector. The head of Hadrian there in the foreground, the figure of Diana that's in his hand, the antique bust. And on the one hand, not only does he look out at us, he's clearly not from the patrician class. He meets our gaze. He's a cittadino. He's a citizen, a collector. And he proffers that statue out to us, while with the other hand, he has his hand over his heart and a cross, showing that, yes, he's a scholar, antiquarian, but that deeply religious in his heart as well. And Lotto does a number of these portraits, again, on the horizontal. This, the gentleman in his study from about 1530, again, with a great deal of attention to the books, the details, what's on the table, as well as to the elegance of that costume. Titian, in the later work, 1540s and 1550s, does powerful images of the ruling class in one form or another. Here, probably posthumous Doge Andrea Gritti from about 1545, after a recent trip to Rome where he had encountered Michelangelo and the strength of that hand clutching that material as he dominates the space monumentally around him in this magnificent robe, with great areas of thick paint and the variety of surface textures becomes increasingly important throughout the 16th century. Here, Titian, in this unlined, unrelined canvas, with great brushstrokes that pull out the highlights of the robe underneath, or that pull out the edge of the fur along here. But Titian is largely working for great princes, including the papacy, as you can see here with Paul III, and working for the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles, and working for King Philip of Spain. And so while he's in the city, his presence isn't as obvious as it would have been earlier in the century. And he does this late, very spiritual self-portrait. And we can see he's in profile. He wears the chain, marking him as the Knight of the Golden Spur. It's a very humble, self-humiliating self-portrait. He doesn't look out at us as the great scholar. He doesn't look out at us as the great painter. It's simple. He holds on to the brush. We have to remember that by this time he's about 70. His late works become the triumph of color and light, and particularly over the kind of sculptural form that he had prized earlier. We can see that here in the 1562-64 Annunciation that's in the Church of San Salvador. It's perhaps the boldest and most freely painted of his late altarpieces. It has a shimmering iridescence, a haze, and it too is molten as he tries to imagine what it was like at the actual Annunciation. The angel coming down into the space, Mary, her arm up, accepting this moment of the incarnation, while the riotous angelic group here accompanies, again, golden but molten, the Holy Spirit as it descends onto Mary. It is atmospheric beyond what we could have imagined in the early Bellini and the early Giorgione. And we can see it over and over again in the drama here as he reimagines the martyrdom of St. Lawrence, which takes place at night, but which St. Lawrence says, there is no night for me, I have the light of God. Now, when you look at something like this, think about the traditional definition of Baroque painting: highly emotionally charged, figures in movement, dramatically illuminated, and all of it's already here, the 1560s in Venice, in the work of Titian, and upstairs in the work of Tintoretto. These late works can be emotionally draining. Here, the flaying of Marcius, done the year that Titian dies, the way in which Apollo, having triumphed over Marcius, demands the flaying, and the literal flaying that's taking place here, a reminder of losses to the Turks that involve the flaying of Venetian captains on Crete and in other places. And it's no accident that Midas over here looks on, pondering this, and that it looks a little like Titian over here as well, thinking about the ramifications of these actions of competition. And so we have this painting. And it's the painting that Titian designed to be over his grave, over the altar, in the Church of the Frari. And it was placed there briefly, but the monks didn't like it. It has traveled to various places. It's ended up in the Academia. But we have to understand it as his final statement. The reference here clearly, again, to those mosaics. Look at the limited color palette and the power of this image, because this is a self-portrait of Titian. Looking up, perhaps approaching 90 years old, thinking about his own mortality. His son has died of the plague the year before, this votive panel with he and his son. And there he is in meditation on death itself. Almost the same moment, another painter has come on the scene. Just a few years earlier, Veronese. Veronese, who did sumptuous feasts with patricians dressed in the most beautiful costumes, enacting the great dinners, no doubt, of their own time. And this painting, now called The Feast in the House of Levy, but originally meant to be a Last Supper, figure Judas over here on our side of the table. This is a figure that was added later on, perhaps to discourage the identification of the painting as a Last Supper. But where are all these luxuriant people dining? But in the great architecture of Palladio, of Sansovino, of the architects that have come to Venice and worked to create the kind of classical architecture and monumental architecture that they now have around the monumental square and along the Grand Canal. And the figures, including the self-portrait of Veronese as the maitre d'. And this is the painting that was attacked by the Inquisition that suggested that it was inappropriate to have dwarves and Germans and dogs at the Lord's Supper. And so he changes it, not even to the feast in the house of Simon, which may have been the idea of putting this figure in, but the feast in the house of Levi, a lesser subject in this way. Wonderful details here. And this was designed for the refectory of San Giovanni e Paolo, where many of the monks were no doubt children of the patricians who had gone into the clergy. So they would have associated with these great banquets as well. Or here, the marriage at Cana, that was done for the refectory of San Giorgio Maggiore, done slightly earlier in 1563. There are over 130 people in this scene. You can't see any means of support for any of them, because the draperies are far more important than the chairs that they're sitting in, except for the musical group down here, which includes portraits of Tintoretto, Titian, and Veronese as musicians orchestrating what's going on in Venice. Again, amidst this marvelous classical architecture that was pioneered by Sansovino and by this time being promoted by Palladio as well. Crucially, upstairs you will find that there is a moment when the plague takes Titian, and there are two great fires in 1574 and 1577 in the Doge's palace, destroying almost all the work of Bellini, almost all the work that Titian had done, and now leaving it open for Veronese and Tintoretto, Palma, Giovine, and others. And so we get this, that central ceiling panel that you see here of the great chamber, the great council chamber in the Palazzo Ducale, which represents the triumph of Venice itself. The ceiling in 1585, separated into different zones. We look up De Soto and Sioux as if looking up from below. We look past the popular population here. We look up past the patricians, and we look up to the allegory of Venice being crowned by the virtues here on either side as we look up into the sky and past that grandiose architecture. One of those great achievements. What I've tried to set up here today is the background for what has happened before Tintoretto comes on the scene, and then what will happen during his lifetime, and then a few of the works that are at the very end of his life as well. And we will see how the young Tintoretto wrestles with both Titian and adapts some of the strategies of some of Titian's perhaps greatest rivals. Thanks so much for coming today.